Right, hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. To bit of a different track tonight. Two very interesting guests, one new, one not so new. Paul and Barry. So Barry Maguire is senior lecturer in philosophy in the University of Edinburgh. Barry, very, very nice to have you. And I actually just met you about 5 minutes ago, so nice to meet you as well.
Thanks very much. Great to be here. Thanks.
And then, as we would say in Scotland, a very well-kent face, Paul Forsyth, consultant, credentialed cardiology pharmacist in Glasgow. Is that close enough, Paul?
Yeah, that's close enough, I think. So thanks, Johnny. It's great to see you again. Delighted to come and try and fix the world of pharmacy tonight. So thanks for inviting me.
So this pair and others have been exploring the existential crisis that pharmacy doesn't know it needs. We know what, well, we don't know how to fix it yet, but we know that pharmacy, in inverted commas, so the pharmacist profession, let's just focus on pharmacists for the sake of this conversation, but we won't forget the wider pharmacy team who are very important as well. But to keep it simple, let's focus on pharmacists. So pharmacists have, we've come through an evolution over the years for, and I think to cut to the chase, it is a tension between the sort of technical role of supply and the new and emerging roles, which some folk in the profession have put under the banner of clinical in inverted commas, isn't that right? But what clinical means is really up for debate. And what's interesting about what Paul and Barry are trying to do is sort of look at that progression from 1990 when Hepler and Strand brought out the pharmaceutical care paper and really translate that or examine and prosecute that sort of transition to autonomous working and that kind of thing. So, and one of the concepts they've come up with, which I'm really keen to speak about tonight, is collaborative care. So, either or, you could fight amongst yourselves, chaps. But would one of you mind? And actually, I've been very remiss. I haven't given Barry a chance to tell us about his professional background, but I'll put it in the show notes. It's too late now. Sorry, Barry. Could one of you maybe have a go at sort of synthesizing the paper that you wrote recently and sort of describe in a nutshell what you mean by collaborative care and what the point of that concept is?
I'll have a go, Johnny. It's a great question. It'll be hard to synthesize in a few minutes, but I'll try and give it my best shot. Go and read the paper, actually, is what we want people to do. And read it quite a number of times and try and take some time with it is the best way. But let's try and give you a short version of it. So, the values of healthcare are pretty similar in every institution, Johnny. NHS, fill in the blank, country A, country B. It's about kind of working together. It's about excellence in health. It's about meeting patients' needs. It's about just delivering a quality service and doing our best for people. So I think we all agree on that. But these are quite hard things actually to deliver in the real world, because the needs of patients and communities changes. It changes over time. It's different from community A to community B, even in the same city. So in order to deliver that kind of excellence and build relationships and fix problems, see new opportunities, we need pharmacists with different types of skill sets. So forget what pharmacists you are, community or cancer or heart disease. That's not actually what our paper's about. Our paper's about what generic skills a pharmacist needs. So perhaps if you need to be adaptive to change, you're going to have some leadership skills where you see things that aren't working, or you've concerns about it, and you put your hand in the air and you start measuring things. You start asking questions and being inquisitive. You start building relationships with other people that maybe are seeing the same kind of problems. And you see yourself really as as someone that's there to deliver care to a patient or to a community. So you define yourself less by your actual tasks that you do per se. Yes, you're interested in drugs, but you're mainly there to help people. And to do that, you need these genetic skills. And you have to work with others to make it work. So there's an element of collaboration. And when you can work together and you can define your values a little bit better and some of your skills, then you start to get this concept more of autonomy, where everybody really understands how we work together, what your role is, what mine is, how we fit. And autonomy, the way that Barry has kind of taught me perhaps over the last 6 months, is a wee bit different from independence, where you go off and just do your own thing. Autonomy is more of this kind of social construct where we understand each other's function and we consent to each other's function. So I think what the paper is trying to say is we have siloed some of these roles too much. I'll just see patients. Johnny, you make all the decisions. Barry will do all the thinking. Somebody else will do the leadership. And we'll just stay in those boxes. But you could never really be responsive to a community's needs if you live in those siloed boxes alone. And perhaps the longer you stay in a profession or in a role, perhaps the more discontent you get in it as well, because perhaps you see problems emerge and you don't really have the control, the authority, the agency to make any difference to these things. And that leads you perhaps to discontentment, maybe sometimes to this word of alienation, of feeling like you don't fit anymore in a system that you should fit in. And maybe sometimes, you know, leaving the profession, feeling unwell, going off in stress, burning out. So we've set this theory that if you don't have these four genetic skills of practice, leadership, education, and research, you probably, in a lot of cases, start to erode some of those values that you probably hold in your heart. You start to not be as connected to other people. And maybe in some people that leads you to one of these more negative endpoints. So we've raised this debate about the generic skills of pharmacists, forgetting what kind of pharmacist you are, that we believe that all pharmacists of the future need these four generic skill sets. And we are not the first people to do this, Johnny. So medicine have been talking about this for decades, nursing are doing it. We've just set a lot of the evidence in the context around pharmacy in a kind of new argument for pharmacy, but not necessarily a new argument for everyone. So that's the short-term version, basically, Johnny. Working together, four skills, seeing yourself as a treater of patients and a treater, a carer for communities. That really is an argument. Barry, that's probably the short version of it. Is there anything you want to add more about
Feel free,
the...
Barry. Yeah, come on ahead. Yeah.
I mean that's a great summary and introduction, Paul. Thanks. Maybe just kind of picking up on a couple of strands that you mentioned there. So one of the ways that we introduce our alternative is with this kind of contrast between an atomistic model and a collaborative model. So the atomistic model is kind of a label for what Paul was describing there, where everybody has their own particular job description, and it consists more or less in some list of tasks that they are responsible for fulfilling. And you can move between different job descriptions and come to be responsible for different sets of tasks. But ultimately, there's just you and your own responsibilities. So that's this kind of atomistic model that we had in mind. And then, of course, at bracket, you get the leaders have their leadership tasks and practitioners have practitioner tasks and so on. And so what we wanted to do was set out a vision that was opposed to that kind of from the bottom to the top. So it's really this idea of collaboration as the kind of driving structuring impulse of the organization of pharmacy. And in some ways this is inevitable. So even with the atomistic model, you've got people working together. The tasks are being divided up And people are doing bits and pieces of other people's labor, and the pharmacists are in turn working with other parts of the public health system. So there is a kind of coordination and there is a kind of collaboration. But our thought was just make that much more intentional, make that much more present-minded, build it into the structure much more deliberately. And so our idea is that, you know, start out by people sharing the values explicitly that Paul articulated, and then sharing a kind of ethos of working together and trying to live up to these kinds of values of meeting patient needs and working together and so on. And then designing institutions that are kind of properly fit with that ethos. And then finally you have individuals with their responsibilities, which are kind of considered as ways of participating in a larger system. So your kind of tasks on a given day aren't, you know, independently your own in quite the same way. They're, as it were, your way of playing your part. So we think it's kind of a different mindset. And so the Paul introduced this kind of distinction between independence and autonomy, and I thought I would maybe also just say something quickly about that, because it might be a kind of helpful concept for some of your listeners
Definitely, yeah, spot on.
that they might not know as much about. So the idea of independence is more or less being left to your own devices, not being interfered with, nobody's physically stopping you from doing something, or maybe the legislation isn't stopping you from doing something, or, you know, maybe the incentives don't stop you from doing something. So you're more or less, you have a kind of sphere of discretion where you're kind of left to your own devices. And the alternative to that is this idea of autonomy as having kind of two aspects. Firstly, it's about living up to your own values. So you're acting autonomously when you're living in accordance with your own values. And an interesting thing about that is you might not have a choice. So there's this lovely distinction from Aristotle, you know, thousands of years ago. He describes some sailors on a boat in a storm. And he says they can throw all their food overboard, and the ship won't capsize. The only way to keep the boat floating is to throw everything overboard. But of course, if they do that, then they won't have any food, and they're going to be in another kind of difficult situation. And he says, you know, if they don't throw the food overboard, they're all going to drown. But nevertheless, they have a choice. They can not throw the food overboard. So there's a kind of difference between, you know, not having a choice on the one hand and like really owning a choice on the other. So when you choose to throw the food overboard, even though, you know, it's that or die, you still can choose. It's still something that's kind of coming from you. So there's this idea of honoring your values, like what is it you really care about, and being able to do that. And then the other side of autonomy is collaboration, is empowerment. It's that you're working within a set of structures that intentionally put you in a position to honor your values, and that again comes back to this idea of you're collaborating either way. It's a system either way. You're all working together in some sense either way, but the system can be designed intentionally to put everyone in a position to honor their values, where we're assuming these are the kinds of values that Paul started out with at the outset.
So that's quite an interesting concept, Johnny, because do many pharmacists have autonomy therefore, where society around them, so people and communities and healthcare professionals of other types really understand their values and their skills, their role and their function, and then grant them this societal power to deliver upon on their skills and values? I think that's missing in pharmacy. I don't actually think it's missing. Look, Barry and I are doing a literature search just now. There's accounts of this from 200 years ago, 300 years ago in pharmacy. It's always been there, that we've never really found this place where everybody understands and consents to the role of the pharmacist in a way that the pharmacist would want. So this is why, again, with working with Barry, we feel that pharmacists are this classic case where they feel a wee bit underutilized, underappreciated. They feel that they could do more. They don't have as much autonomy as they would like, not independence, like go and do what you want, but just society using them in a more effective way. that we believe this is missing, and but we believe that pharmacy structures are one of the contributors to that. So it's not society necessarily that got wrong. Perhaps our structures lead us more to that place.
I think it's fascinating. Before I spoke to you today, I was like, where are we going here? there's so much within this, but we need to start at the start. So Barry, you both mentioned collaboration quite a lot. So, and Paul knows I'm fairly direct, and you know, in terms of, I think within our profession, the Overton window has diminished over the last few years, and the ability to debate things is problematic for some, depending on what position, perhaps your employment or your bosses don't like you speaking about certain things, but we need to talk about it. And one of the context to this next point or question really for me is around the relative weakness of our profession in the wider healthcare ecosystem. I am thinking from a selfish pharmacist point of view, you know. I think, I mean, Barry, I'm sure you're aware that the General Pharmaceutical Council split from, well, the Royal Pharmacy, Royal Pharmaceutical Society of Great Britain became the Royal Pharmaceutical Society, and the General Pharmaceutical Council was born, I don't know, 15 years ago or whatever it was. And since then, in my view, we've never really, for myriad reasons, never really grasped the nettle. And what that has led to, in my view, is drift, collective drift. Now, I did a little bit of extra reading before speaking to you around collaboration. And one of the key things in collaboration, as I understand it, and you guys could probably keep me right here, as I understand it, to collaborate with anyone or you know, let's say a couple of organizations collaborating together, the one thing, well, you've got to get six or seven things right along the way, but one of the key initial things is values. And I know you speak about values. And I think the question for me is, in light of the weakness of our profession, the sort of intellectual drift or apathy, Paul, you mentioned that word anime, how, in your, you know, to operationalize your model, how can you be sure that pharmacists' values align? Because it strikes me that that's an assumption you've made within it.
So there's loads of, as you said at the outset there as well, Johnny, there's loads of issues there that you're raising.
Sorry.
no, it's terrific. I mean, so when Paul and I first started talking seriously about this, he made me realise something that's actually, I think, really quite profound and important thinking about theory and policy and really just about any context, or in a lot of context. And so and it does also go back to the way Paul began his remarks, which is to say, at some level of granularity, most people pretty much accept the values that we are articulating. We want to care about one another. We want workers to have autonomy. We want to be collaborating together. We want to give workers recognition for their work, and we want to give the public respect and recognition for their circumstances. You know, these are all kind of high-powered philosophical concepts on one level, but they're also banal, ordinary, everyday words that everyone would kind of understand and accept. And so the thing that Paul kind of made me realize, coming from, as it were, theory down, is that at some level in organizational design and power structures, you've got people already signed on to the right values. What's lacking is a specification of those values and an operationalization of that specification. Sorry for that horrible sentence. But
No, but I get it. I agree. I get it.
A more precise rendering of the values, a conception of the concept, as a famous philosopher John Rawls put it, you want a specification and you want an implementation model that works with that more specific characterization. And so that's in a way what we've been trying to do with collaborative care. And so the argument, if you like, from values is an inclusive one. It's an internal one. It's kind of a conversation between friends, because the first premise, if you like, is, look, here are our values. But most people don't have the time to do the, hard work of really try to pin down, what do you mean by autonomy? What do you mean by collaboration? What do you mean by community? The stuff that we are going to talk about a bit today, and that, is kind of our bread and butter in a way. A lot of people don't have the time for that. And then there's a separate part of it, which is, okay, now we've got this more precise rendering of some of these values. How do we think about, what's the ideal workforce model? And then there's a kind of, how do you get from A to B kind of question. And so I think on some level the argument is kind of already won in a way, at least in Scotland. And actually, Paul and I have been talking to people in pharmacy systems around the world, and by and large, we're all kind of on the same page. It seems to me. So that's kind of one thing. Maybe just one more thing. I know Paul will be desperate to get in as well, but one more quick thing on the way pharmacy is engaging with other parts of the public health systems. There's a kind of argument from efficiency, actually two arguments from efficiency. So I think from the little bit of exposure I've had to what's going on in pharmacy in Scotland in particular, a wee bit more broadly than that, that you have an underutilized workforce that's suffering from its underutilization. So you've got this kind of alienation that comes from being kind of highly trained and underemployed on a day-to-day basis. And that's a problem for those workers, because they would flourish better in a system that empowered them to act on our values in the ways that we've been kind of characterizing. So on the one hand, you've got a workforce that's ready to go and would be much better off if it were just kind of let loose. But on the other hand, that if they were let loose, they could do more work. And so they could also contribute more to public health. So it seems to me like in both respects, you've got a kind of win-win. And so that's another kind of argument for collaboration
Just
that I think
before
is actually quite easily won.
you go on, and please do keep going, but absolutely fascinating. And this is where the in practice bit comes in, because I would argue that I'm actually a working example of what you just said. I'm a locum pharmacist working in community pharmacy. I've got experience. I've got my independent prescribing training, and I have experience to practice at a certain level, and contractually, I'm not allowed to do that. Now, interestingly, from the point that you've just made, I'm choosing autonomy, i.e., self-employment. But because I'm choosing autonomy, I'm being penalised and I'm underutilised, which is a terrible shame. Because some of the interventions that I could clearly make are high impact, very low risk.
But
Sorry to interrupt you, Barry. Sorry.
that's an interesting bit, Johnny, because what, although you're probably not choosing, it's probably not the right word, you're probably in some ways been structurally forced into it to an extent, because maybe you can't find what you need in that bigger profession. But is that autonomy that you've got, or is that independence? Because you've got now a lot of independence to do what you want, to make your own decisions, to do this. But does that system around you grant that? And do you interact with it in a way that both parties understand and value and recognize and kind of share and stuff? Sure, me and you and Barry, and there's lots that do, but does that whole pharmacy system around you, would it understand some of that to make it that collective autonomy? Like, Johnny, go and deliver us pharmacy in practice, go and be this person. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that maybe that's a response to the fact that you can't get some of those things in the profession. And it's the same way that people like myself or Gordon Rushworth that you know or others have kind of reared against the system to try and come up with new thinking, new concepts, new ways. It's probably a response to maybe a discontentment again with the system. So you should be able to get those things where you take that independent prescribing qualification in and go and utilize it in a way that works for you, in a way that works for the community. But to get that, all the employers and all the communities would need to be set up in a way that allows that, and they're not. So perhaps that lack of finding it within the profession has driven you to an extent out into self-employment. That would be one of my thoughts there, Johnny. So we just need to think then about how do we operationalize this, which is your question. So going back to Barry's thing, what's the specification? Well, the specification actually for this has been written by the Royal Pharmaceutical Society in their curriculum. They've been written into the four pillars of practice plus a fifth domain for kind of values and collaboration. And they've been written at the different levels of, look, you're just starting out, you're foundation, you have to keep things safe, and we'll give you a little bit of rope to play with, but not too much, just enough to look after yourself. Okay, you're becoming more respective, you're becoming more skillful, you're building more relationships. Everybody can see that a little bit more. Okay, let's give you more rope to play with. You can start looking after teams and services for me and playing and innovating and trying new things. Okay, you're getting more skillful. You've built more relationships. Everybody around you is valuing you more. Okay, I'll let you play with an organizational kind of level of stuff. You might need to dial back on some of the individual practice, but I'm going to give you this more responsibility collectively to underpin this organization, to get us all working. So again, it's always about paying back to the system, but it's implemented in that structure of the RPS, a foundation, advanced consultant, four pillars and a fifth one of values. That infrastructure and specification is there now. Now, the NHS in direct employment for me or for any of my team could start hanging career progression next to these concepts about working with others and giving back to the system. And you could do this in private enterprise as well, where governments who commission contracts for community pharmacy for different things reward essentially delivering care and paying back to the system and using this more level of skill as you get higher up. So we could contract on this basis as well, directly or through contractors. So this could work if we incentivize it, and the specification is there from the RPS. You know, pharmacy is a terrible one for thinking, oh, there's the RPS, they've written this thing, but it's not right. I'm going to go and write my own thing. Well, that's division. You know, at some stage, we're going to have to choose to come together in an imperfect way to begin with and trying to start build these attempts at community in a way that do not exist in pharmacy just now. So only pharmacy can actually deliver their own path to autonomy, because they have to choose collaboration, and that collaboration will allow them then to perform a service that patients can see and feel in a more consistent way. And that will lead us to a stage where healthcare professionals and patients are happy to grant us more recognition and more autonomy. So we are the prophets of our own downfall here by picking division. That, after 20 years in pharmacy, is my assessment of pharmacy. We have to choose collaboration and choose to integrate the RPS thinking into our structures and into our contracts and incentivize collaboration.
So much within that. I wasn't expecting to go so existential in my own career. I would say, just to finish off the thing about the locum thing and all, good point you make about, is it independence or autonomy? I need to reflect on that. I think where I've ended up is a defensive pattern. Based on alienation.
Absolutely. So the best example sometimes of true autonomy in pharmacy is a single owner community pharmacist that is their own boss. So they have the leadership, they have a little team around them, they need to educate. They're always trying new things because they're a business and they have to keep, financially secure. And they're also delivering the practice. And they generally then have to make links with the other bits around them in a relationship way, the community and the GP, to get you know, some form of recognition, to get a name for themselves, to feel that they're part of the community. And when they get that, patients tend to start coming to them more. So I used to be a community pharmacy locum when I first started. And I remember, you know, working in a particular area where there was two pharmacies right next door to each other, and one was jumping and one was quiet. Now, why do the patients go to the one that's jumping when they can go to the one that's quiet?
Mm.
Because they're delivering them something different that's more integrated, that delivers their values and their care better, and that person's finding more autonomy in their community. So this can be done, and it is done in some excellent examples of single-handed community pharmacies and others as well. But when you scale organisations up and up and up and up, including in the NHS, this becomes harder. It's always easier in these little micro organisations.
I'll come to you in a minute, Barry, but I am selfishly interested in just finishing this bit of the conversation. And yes, it is all about me, sorry. But my search for autonomy has led me out with the profession. That alienation actually made me step out. And I started, Barry will be interested to hear, maybe I started a forestry company, and totally different field, completely alienated. And that was my craving autonomy, and that really that owner, community pharmacy owner feeling. And I've had that, and I don't need that anymore. I've got that elsewhere. So just what you're saying is really interesting. Barry, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm really just elaborating a little bit on a point that Paul made, but maybe what I'm hoping to do is make this connection between autonomy and collaboration a little bit less mysterious. You know, so independence is really just kind of being left to yourself. It's about people not interfering with you. Whereas you know, Paul's been emphasizing, and I've mentioned that autonomy is, you know, it's about honouring your values, but being empowered to do so. And this empowerment entails a form of collaboration with others. So take an example now. Take the case that Paul mentioned. So take somebody, and we'll come back to your particular case, Johnny, but I think that this is a sort of clearer, starker version in a way that also straightforwardly applies.
It's not all about me either, which is quite
well, nice. No, but yours is a nice example, but just to work on a slightly simpler one, you know, or rather to work with a hypothetical, and then it'll apply. You know, so imagine somebody who owns their own pharmacy and employs some staff, and they can decide, you know, what hours they work and what happens in the shop and so on. And now suppose that the local GPs, and I don't want to annoy any GPs, but it's just a hypothetical. Suppose that they don't respect the pharmacist. They don't respect the pharmacist as a clinician, as you put it earlier on. They think basically the pharmacist is there to fulfill the prescriptions that they provide. So they kind of disrespect the pharmacist. Now, this pharmacist is being left to their own devices. They own their own shop. They're in charge of their own business. What that pharmacist wants to do is care for their community. They want to contribute to public health. They want to look after the people in their community. And they can't do that because the GPs aren't respecting them. There's going to be cases where they would want to maybe influence the medications that somebody is getting, or they want to be able to offer more advice. They want to look at a broader range of people. They want to push back against some of the advice that some of the patients are getting, and they can't do that because they're not listened to, they're not recognised, they're disrespected. So they've got independence. They can do what they want in their own shop, but they've not got autonomy because they're not empowered to honour their values, which in this case is to use their skills to promote public health in collaboration. So like just that, from that one example, you can see how, you know, being left to yourself isn't a way of being autonomous. And actually, if you take that, if you just like think about the way that argument works, anything that inhibits you're doing your best to kind of bring your skills to the table to do your bit for public health is an inhibition of your autonomy. So actually you need the whole system working together, empowering everybody in it, in order for anyone to have autonomy in a robust sense. So this kind of idea of, oh, I can just extract and I can get a certain amount of power and then maybe I can get this thing that I want, is with due respect, kind of completely wrong-headed from the perspective of this way of thinking about autonomy. And so that, obviously, I think does go back to your case. Like, if you think that there's a, as I do, and I think Paul does, if there's a very tight connection between autonomy and alienation and feelings of, you know, meaninglessness and burnout and just despondency and losing interest, and there's actually good scientific, psychological research on this, self-determination theory, but if you think there are these connections, then it's perfectly explicable that from the circumstance that you've described, you would end up feeling kind of alienated and not empowered.
Well,
so I'm interested in this as well, Johnny. So I'm fascinated as well. I know your story, and we've chatted many times about, you know, going and doing the forestry stuff. So Barry's got me really interested in this concept also of meaningful work. So it's meaningful to do what Barry's just describing there of trying to find that public health need and help your patients and integrate and stuff. But it's also meaningful to run a forestry business and to provide fuel to people and to be part of the community. And aye, Johnny, I need a few bags. Aye, come on up, I'll cut them for you just now. Let's cut them while you're here. You know, so meaningful work probably comes in a number of different ways. Like, you know, being a baker is just as meaningful as being a pharmacist, actually, you know, because you're feeding your community. So again, and Barry's got me interested when I hear your story, Johnny. I think you couldn't find that autonomy that Barry says of everybody giving you the power and the empowerment to do what you felt met your skills. So you went and did something else that you deemed was meaningful, and meaningful might have been providing logs to your local community up in Grampy, and that actually made you kind of feel better. So we need to be careful in pharmacy, because when you take some of these concepts then of meaning out of their job, either through intra or interprofessional politics or structures, people lose meaning. And when people lose meaning, they get alienated sometimes. When they get alienated, they're more likely to feel frazzled, to go off sick, to leave the profession, you know, just to be unhappy. So I think we're seeing this more in pharmacy just now, or maybe we're not. Maybe Barry and I are just talking to people about it more. But this, it's getting to this stage of, have I let you do something in accordance to your values and skills in a way that gives you autonomy, and then you can feel some meaning and warmth when you've gone home, like, I contributed to the people around me. I would put back to you, Johnny, you did that in your forestry job. That's probably why you liked it, you know, but you maybe couldn't get that in your pharmacy job.
Yeah. I think let's take it away from me, because that's enough about me.
It's like a therapy session.
It is. It's nice. Thanks, Barry. Thanks for coming along. And you're on it. You know, all you need to you need a coach. But yeah, let's take it away. I think so. You're asking me a question there, actually, Paul. Around, is it just because you're talking about this collaborative care thing that you're describing? You know, are you wanting to see it? Are you trying? You know, is there a problem, or is there actually a problem there? And what is the problem you're trying to fix? I think there's a few things in pharmacy circles that are quite interesting at the moment that can maybe give you a barometer of that. One of them is this supervision debate. And Barry, I don't know how much you know about this, but long story short, it's basically how a pharmacy is supervised. And there's concern, I think, that there's going to be scope creep from the wider pharmacy team. And Paul, I don't know what you think, but I sense... And this to me indicates that you do need to have this conversation, because this supervision debate really comes down for me. Is it a glass half full or a glass half empty scenario? So glass half empty is locum, always got the rate I've got for turning up most of the time on time, basically doing 80% of a technical task. Manning the pharmacy as responsible pharmacist, I'm worried, I'm glass half empty, because possibly a pharmacy technician could quite shortly be able to fulfill 80% of that technical task. I'm feeling anemic, potentially. I'm feeling disillusioned, defensive, possibly heading towards alienation as you describe it. I would be on the other side. I suppose, go back to me, I stepped right out of the profession to try and be glass half full, I guess. But glass half full in this supervision scenario would be, I need more time to develop my collaborative care model. I need more time to go and network with my local GP. I need more time to develop my skills as an independent prescriber and actually work towards advanced practice. I need more time to talk to my local population so that I meaningfully know what they need. So I don't know if that's not really a question. It was just more of a rant, but I think you are answering or trying to answer a problem that is there. And what I hope people listening might hear is that there are glass half full people out there, you know, you are not alone, stick in kind of thing. I'd love that population of worried employees and locums, pharmacists, whatever, that glass half empty cohort to just can't stop them being worried or feeling alienated to an extent, but just try and lean into this, maybe this collaborative care model, and think, how can I move forward, and what does the future hold, maybe in 5-10 years time? Don't know what you think to that, Paul.
So this is tricky. So I was talking to Barry earlier before this call, just about, you know, even my own career, Johnny. So I started university in 1997, back in the old Royal College building, old Victorian building, essentially, in Strathclyde University. You know, you still learn to make suppositories in brass moulds. I remember working in Bannerman's Pharmacy as a Saturday boy and, you know, making 1% coal tar, you know, ointment or whatever. And you probably wouldn't even be allowed to do that now because it's carcinogenic. But, you know, all those roles over 30 years have left the profession. So we're not talking about 100 years or 200 years or 300 years. We're talking about less than one person's professional career. So if we look at the people that are coming towards the end of their career just now and the people that are just at the start, that whole concept of what a pharmacist says and what it does, and I know you've had a previous podcast with Zubin Austin, that whole professional identity is radically changed at a rapid rate.
Mm-hmm.
And the old norms have dissolved, but the new norms haven't formed yet. And even if the new norms are forming or are mainly formed, they're certainly not recognised by others yet in this way that allows staff to find autonomy. And there's potentially not training programmes there to really build your confidence and your skill set into some of these new training programmes. So we are in this transitional stage just now where a lot of people are feeling anxious across some of those divides of changing roles. I'm not sure there is an easy approach to this. So I'm not sure there's a magic wand that we can do. But the one thing that we have to do to begin with is be respectful, I suppose, of all of those people and all of the roles, because you know, what people started doing and what they might be asked now might end up being quite different.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we can enforce these things just now, but I think over another generation, perhaps, we need to be clearer on what the function of a pharmacist is, and a technician and a support worker and different things. I think that is a debate that I think if we continue to hide it in a cupboard somewhere, we are going to stay in this anxiety-ridden kind of profession. So yeah, I think the way to further that is a mixture of respect and debate just now, and to be gentle in our approach as to how we're building in and supporting these concepts, but to be clearer on the direction of travel here, because some of these roles that you spoke about, ultimately, if we look at the changes in the profession and pharmacists and technicians, will become technician responsibilities. And the pharmacist is going to have to ultimately look at that more tailoring of therapy and picking the right drug for the right person and helping the other members of the MDT form that function. That's a function that pharmacists used to form, you know, 300 years ago before we split into pharmacists and GPs and we were apothecaries. So we've held that function in the past. So people will tell you it's not the role of a pharmacist. Maybe it's not the role in the last 100 years, but maybe it has been in the past. So this is hard, Johnny. This is not going to change overnight. So I'll get to retire and this won't be fixed. But we do need this debate about where we're going. So at least the people that are coming into the profession now are not going straight into an anxiety-ridden profession full of anime. Because that is what I see as the middle point in my career. When I look up and down in that age and career spectrum, I do see anxiety just now.
No, I see it as well. And I'm thinking, I often reflect, like, how do we collectively get through that impasse? I think the supervision legislative proposition is again quite a useful thing. If I was being Machiavellian about that, I caveat this by saying, and to Barry, you know, certain sectors of pharmacy have progressed quicker. For example, hospital pharmacy, it's well known, has progressed more rapidly towards sort of along the road to what you're trying to describe, really, whereas community pharmacy for various reasons hasn't. So that's why this supervision thing is so interesting, because if I was being Machiavellian about it, the success of the pharmacist almost depends, or it could be argued, really depends on the pharmacy technician swallowing up some of that traditional community pharmacist role.
And that's a beautiful point. So that's why our autonomy is dependent on other people. It's another version of what Barry told you in the past, that for pharmacists to find their place, pharmacy technicians need to find their place as well. That you will never get the fit of one without the fit of another. So this is another version where that collaborative, integrated RPS and APTUC, for argument's sake, working together on a common view for this is much better than division like this. Of both planning in a silo, kind of fighting for their own independence.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what they want. They want to understand how they work together. So I'm sick of pharmacy arguing about this doesn't work for me, so I'm saying no to it. I think the true leaders in the profession are going to have to come together and see how these things fit together. But they're difficult conversations, Johnny. So they're easy ones to kind of stick to the side and just try and work your days out.
Definitely. You know. And there are, you know, the other legislative change on the horizon that I was going to mention was pharmacy technicians being able to do patient group directives. And that is another significant change, which swallows up some of that workload that the traditional community pharmacist would have done. And I feel it's like, it's forward pressure, isn't it? And to my point about glass half full or glass half empty, you know, that it's not that there's friction, it's just that there's pressure. But what, I don't know what you think about this, but what does sort of sadden me in terms of the professional leadership in our profession, and sort of maybe speaks to why the chief pharmaceutical officers, i.e., you know, the government by proxy, really. The thing that worries me or saddens me slightly about the professional leadership in the profession is that we're being led by the regulator in some ways, it could be argued. So a change in supervision laws could push the pharmacy technicians forward. A change in their being allowed to do patient group directions and so on could push them forward and add pressure elsewhere in the system. And I just say that that's a pretty low bar, in my opinion.
And this is another good example.
From a pharmacist point of view. Sorry, Paul. Yeah.
This is another good example of why Barry and I believe in collaborative care. So when you have a regulator over here that's job's just regulation, so it's not practicing, it's not educating others, it's not researching, it's just regulating. And you've practitioners over here and leaders up here, that these things don't work in silos, because the regulator starts to lose concept of the practice, the practitioners can't lead, the leaders can't regulate. That this is why, in my view, MD working for a regulator should have four pillars in their job. They should be a practitioner some of the time, maybe a session a month, maybe a locum like yourself, Johnny, a few times a month.
Yeah.
They should be teaching young students about regulation and different things, changing roles. They should be researching on what people think about regulation and what it's, you know, so rather than do these kind of semi-scientific, you know, consultation exercises and it's all quite opaque, you can do probably some quite interesting research on what people think of regulation and what the community would like it to become and what they're worried about. And, we could have that. So regulators need to be four pillar in the same way that practitioners need to be four pillar and leaderships need to be four pillar. So this is one of the another example of why we think that atomism doesn't work. Because if they're just buzzing around as a single atom of a regulator, they are not connected and don't understand the other things well enough, and they therefore don't have any autonomy because we sneer at them and they just tell us what to do. So this is still division. Four pillars in that regulator is the way to break that down.
Can I add a wee bit to that, kind of looking at the other side of it? So there's this concept that Paul and I have talked a bit about, and it kind of comes up in other parts of political philosophy as well, of like distributed leadership. I just taught a senior seminar on economic democracy, which is about, giving everybody a certain amount of control in the workplace. And the kind of flip side of the four pillar model, that means the leaders need to do a bit of practicing and teaching and researching, but everybody else is doing a bit of leading. And so what you get is the distribution of the power to structure the organization right through the entire organization. So that again, seems to kind of jive with the value of collaboration. But I wanted to make a slightly different, or I mean, it's not even really a different point, but go back to this idea of respect and debate. Ideally, like everybody, every throughout the system, and beyond, like people on the street, who are going to have to think differently about pharmacists. You want everybody to be kind of having debates about values and identity and thinking about it, like because ultimately you want everyone to have a certain amount of control, and with with power comes responsibility. So you want people to be able to kind of make the right choices. So I think debate is exactly like the right, like it would be, I would love it if somebody would push back and say, oh, you've got the specification of autonomy or collaboration or something else. But actually, I don't think that's right. You're drawn on this thing. What about this alternative that draws on this other heritage and actually tends to support this other kind of system? Because, I've got my own substantive commitments just like everybody else, and so has Paul. And so it would be, I would love to see a kind of flourishing of debate about values and identity and these kinds of things. Like there's a sort of eerie amount, as we were saying earlier, the agreement's a little eerie, and it suggests to me not that we're right, but that there's not enough people quite yet involved. I mean, I think we're also right.
I think, but yeah, I think it's a and that would seem like a nice place to draw things to a close, really. But it is that's a positive to end on, Barry, isn't it? There is hope that I think what you're describing is very logical, sensible, pragmatic, realistic, achievable, scalable, I think. Why not? And ultimately quite exciting. I don't hear an awful lot of similar debate in the profession. I think in pharmacy circles, Barry, we really, really, and this Zubin speaks a lot about this, we love to sweat the small stuff. We love the detail and avoiding jeopardy in the process. So maybe it's just the transition we're on, I hope it is. But
Let's have the debate.
it's been lovely to meet you, Barry, and chat, and Paul, as ever, thank you very much. Now you're not, I have to put in a shameless plug for our conference. We've got, believe it or not, 80 registrants as of this evening. So our first ever conference, Barry, is in May, 23rd of May, in the Novotel Hermiston Gate, very glamorous location, Novotel and Hermiston Gate, rock and roll. But I'm honestly absolutely delighted that folk are interested to come along to see Zubin Austin and this conversation, and I don't know if we've had a debate really, more a conversation, really sets the tone for what we're trying to take forward, encourage, support, all in a very welcoming, collaborative environment. So yeah, you're very welcome to come along, Barry.
Thanks very much. I look forward to it.
All right, chaps, we'll unless there's anything else for anything else, we'll draw it to a close. And thank you very much for joining us.
Brilliant.
Absolutely
Thanks
fantastic
for having
chat.
us tonight, Johnny. That was really great. Thank you.
Thanks so much.